Today's guest, I am pleased and honored to introduce, is Dr. Anita Sawyer. And Dr. Sawyer has written a memoir that, in addition to having won awards, has been described in many ways, including noted for its insightful writing and, quite frankly, its honesty. Let's meet Dr. Anita Sawyer and hear about her story and her memoir in more detail. Dr. Anita Sawyer, thank you so much for joining us here on Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Dr. Sawyer, one of the descriptions of your book, and I am quoting now, is that it is an illuminating story about understanding PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and making emotional sense of events that can lead a soul to darkness. Most of all, it's a story of perseverance, of pain, acceptance, healing, hope, and ultimately success. It really is quite a story. And I think what I'd like to do is to start our conversation not at the beginning of your story, which we will come back to, but really at where you are now. So if you would, introduce yourself to the audience. Who are you? What's going on in your life today?
I'm a 72-year-old clinical psychologist. I've been in practice for over 30 years, 25 years in my own office. I'm a grandmother, and I have become a writer in order to tell my story.
Well, it certainly sounds like you lead a life that, you know, just kind of makes sense to a lot of people. You are working in a field that presumably you enjoy since you've been in it for a bit. You have a family, you have a life, you're a writer, you do many things. One of the more startling things, though, about the title of your book, which is entitled Smoking Cigarettes, Eating Glass, is in fact there was a time in your life when you actually did eat glass. It's like you were trying to slice yourself up from the inside. What was going on?
I was a very disturbed adolescent. I thought that I was evil and sinful, and that this is also a very adolescent thing. I thought I would save the world by killing myself because I was so horrible.
You know, in today's world, the minute I think almost any clinician hears that, the evil, sinful part, you start to wonder what's going on at home and how did this child learn this information about him or herself? Is there any abuse? I mean, it's a reasonable question. But as you were coming up, that did not cross minds at all. And in fact, you were treated. When was the first time that you were actually hospitalized?
It was less than a month after my 17th birthday in 1960.
So and you were in high school?
I was in high school. I was a junior. It's the end of my junior year.
And what happened?
Well, I had written it. I kept a diary, and I had written in the diary that I was planning to kill myself by walking out into the ocean on a Memorial Day trip with my friends. So it was just about, what would that be? That would be 55 years ago.
Okay.
My mother read the diary, and my parents drove out to the cottage where my friends and I were on the tip of Long Island, and they packed me up and took me to the hospital. We had a big psychiatric hospital in our hometown.
Okay. So they packed. Were you surprised to see them?
I don't remember, but I'm sure I was.
Did your mom routinely read your diary?
I had no idea, but I think she probably didn't. I probably left it where she could. That's a really interesting question that nobody's ever asked me. And so I actually my family was very repressed and sort of survived by not knowing things. So I have to think she didn't.
Well,
but for some reason she worried, and some motherly instinct made her look.
Well, you know, it's the unconscious mind is such an extraordinary thing, if you will. It's interesting to hear you say that you might have left it out in a place that she could see.
Yes. I certainly respect the unconscious, both on her part and mine.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so your parents drive up, pick you up, and they take you immediately to a psychiatric hospital. In those days, what did it take for you to be admitted?
Well, probably not much, but in fact, by then I was barely speaking above a whisper.
Mm.
I think anybody, any clinician that looked at me would quickly surmise I was in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't use the second I couldn't say I. Mm-hmm. I referred to myself in the second person. I just cringed. You couldn't hear my talk. My handwriting had gotten so small, my English teacher said he wouldn't read my papers anymore if I didn't make it larger. There was no difference between capital and small letters. I was trying in all kinds of ways to say I was in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, literally disappearing in front of people.
That's all I wanted was to disappear.
What had gone on in your life before this time that would bring you to these kinds of behaviors where you fought so hard not to be seen?
I would have to guess that some of it was I was advancing, and I would have to sort of be a woman in the world, which terrified me.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect there were still threats at home from implications of what my father might be doing. I was a very high achieving youngster, and I was in plays and I was in the yearbook and I was in the honor society. But I also came from a family where my father shamed my brothers and my mother by pointing to my accomplishments. So it was a very double-edged situation where doing all the admirable things I was doing was also causing pain for people I cared about.
So
it was hurting people.
Certainly singling you out in the least helpful way, quite frankly, imaginable, perhaps setting you up for harm as well.
Yes.
And so for you, by May of 1960, you were ready. Do you think that you were, I mean, the part of you that didn't leave the diary out for Mom to happen across, was that part of you really ready just to be gone?
Yes, I was. And I think it was also exacerbated, ironically, by the fact that the play that we were giving that spring was The Crucible.
Mm.
And I was playing the part of a girl that was in trouble politically for being accused of doing, you know, vile things.
So it almost is as though the universe was sort of coming together in a way that didn't feel good, but sort of forced your hand.
Yes.
So talk about that first hospitalization. You were just shy, quite frankly, of graduating. You'd finished your junior year. You had finished your junior year, yes?
No, this was my junior year.
This was your junior year.
We had a month to go.
Okay.
Or 3 weeks or something like that.
All right, so just shy of finishing your junior year.
Yeah.
You know, which for a lot of folks, at that point, you're a junior in high school. You're looking forward to being a senior. You're looking forward to all kinds of things. You're looking forward to parties and boys and girls and everything else. And you were in a psychiatric hospital. What was that like for you?
It was both terrifying and a sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Because as I listened to you talk about the parties and the boys, and that's another feature of being 17 that I was absolutely terrified of.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't carry it on anymore. So the hospital was terrifying because they gave me shock treatment. They didn't understand me. And so I was very lonely, and it certainly didn't change my wish to disappear or my self-hatred. But I think it was, I have to say, looking back, I think it also was a relief.
You just used a term that some people perhaps need some more clarity about, shock treatment. So I'm going to ask you in a moment to explain that. But before I ask you to explain what that means and what that is, what kind of diagnosis were you given such that shock treatment seemed to be the reasonable treatment?
I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which was what I refer to as the diagnosis du jour at the time.
Yeah.
Which is that you didn't have to do much to qualify for a schizophrenia diagnosis. Pretty much any teenager that walked in would probably be diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Which is a pretty big diagnosis.
It was a big diagnosis, and I have a certain amount of passionate feelings about diagnosis, but it, on the other hand, I was really frightened, but I was a very sort of well-read, romantic poet type of teenager, mm-hmm. so I spoke in metaphor, trying to say what I needed to say without actually having to take responsibility for it. And so I could see that they would easily think I was not making sense.
Yeah, that would help the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Dr. Sawyer, we're going to take a break right now, but when we come back with this background, I'm going to ask you to explain to the audience what shock treatment is and what the thinking was. And this was a long time ago. This was in 1960.
Yes.
What the thinking was in terms of shock treatment as a treatment for schizophrenia. We will be right back, folks, and that's where we will begin. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Stay where you are. There's more to come. Dr. Sawyer, you are a young girl, you're in psychiatric care, and you are about to be administered shock treatment. What exactly is shock treatment? What was it in 1960?
As much as I've been able to establish, it was a procedure whereby the doctors attached electrodes to the individual's temples and sent a electricity, gave them an a jolt of electricity which caused a seizure. And they believe that that somehow disrupted old patterns of thought and would enable people to kind of get a fresh start in their thinking.
So literally electricity sort of being pumped into your brain.
That was my understanding, and I haven't actually been able to find anything more sophisticated. An electrical charge that would set off a seizure. Well, they gave me 20, and then they gave me 25, and then over the course of 3 years, what I found out when I read the records a dozen or so years ago was that, in fact, I had 89 shock treatments before I was 20.
89. That number is, in the context of what we're talking about, is so incredibly huge. Take us through the second hospitalization. What did you have benefit from that?
The second hospital, or going back after being readmitted?
Going back after being readmitted.
That was actually a disaster, I think. I believe I was somehow back in the hospital because that part of me felt that was a safer place to be. But they were very frustrated with me, and they gave me more shock treatment. And then when I still didn't get better, they gave me even more shock treatment, which is how we got up to 89. And then they gave up. And I just pretty much stayed quiet in my room or wherever I was, and I gave up too, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that you could not be cured, which is essentially what you were being told, what impact did that have, do you think, on you? Did you focus on, I mean, you already saw yourself as evil and sinful, and now, you know, something is so wrong that it cannot be fixed or reversed. Did you ever focus on that experience or that thought?
I think I simply removed myself from life. And I became one of those people that just sat and stared. I did have nightmares, and I was fearful of everything, but I just lost all interest in anything. And was, I guess, in some ways, an empty shell.
So for somebody on the outside looking in, with, you know, I could easily see somebody saying, absolutely schizophrenic. She stares, she's disconnected, she, you know, sort of fill in the litany of blanks. And was there ever a time, I wonder, when you were diagnosed properly from your perspective?
No, partly because we know so much more now.
Indeed.
And can assess it correctly. PTSD had not been identified. As close as they had was shell shock for veterans of the World Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't know, but I mean, they just didn't ever question that I was schizophrenic. I guess the other thing that would make me would make someone question that was that from the midst of this kind of vacant, passive person, I would occasionally have rages, and I would smash my head against the wall, and I stuck pins in my legs, and I also wouldn't eat.
You
so,
wouldn't eat?
No, I still remember being forced having somebody hold my hands and forcing me to eat cherry pie, which is the ultimate irony, seems to me. So I just pretty much rejected whatever they had to offer me.
Talk about the time that you ate glass. What was going on then?
The glass was in the next hospital.
Okay.
I should probably say that thanks to the universe, I guess, they didn't ship me to a state hospital when they gave up, because my mother's best friend from grammar school was now the wife of the lieutenant governor. And so rather than send me to a state hospital, which would have been the end of me, I'm sure, they sent me to Columbia's Teaching Hospital, which was the New York State Psychiatric Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And the director was required to take them because this was ordered by, the high-up politicians.
Right.
But I had so I was very fortunate that I got transferred, not shipped to Rockland. But I had a doctor I couldn't connect with, and I was still a very withdrawn, isolated, and self-loathing girl. And so the eating glass came from a suicide attempt when I was just before I was 21. And I cut myself with a razor, and I drank some Clorox, and I smashed a light bulb and ate the glass. Fortunately, I got away with it.
That sounds like an awful lot of pain. I mean, we know that suicide is a lot of pain. I mean, the suicide attempts come from a lot of pain, but that just sounds like so much emotional pain. Dr. Sawyer, I'd just like to add the caveat that we're talking about mental health treatment from a while ago. I just want to make sure that folks remember that. In the 1960s, 70s, folks who went into state psychiatric facilities, in a lot of ways, kind of, it was the end of them, because there wasn't a lot of awareness about ways to treat a lot of different illnesses. And certainly women, I would suggest, were easily shipped off to state hospitals if they were noncompliant.
Yes.
The experiences that you had with therapists who were actually helpful to you, can you talk about one of those?
I certainly can. Shortly after, about 2 months, I guess, after that suicide attempt, the doctor switched, because it was a teaching hospital, and as of July 1st, it would be a new set of psychiatry residents.
Okay.
And so I had the immense good fortune that July 1st to have a very talented psychiatry resident who saved my life, made all the difference.
Saved your life.
I have to think he did. Mm. I'm sure he did.
Mm.
He's also responsible for my becoming a psychologist because I wanted to be able to pass on what he had given me.
Hmm. How did he save your life? What was different about that interaction? What was so powerful about that interaction? So powerful in healing.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I believe it's because of who he is. He knew who he was. He was self-confident, but especially he was able to meet me where I was. He didn't need me to be some kind of creation of his. He was there as himself, and he was able to see me as myself. And He wasn't afraid of me, and he paid attention.
The diagnosis of schizophrenia, did it change at any point?
As a matter of fact, not during that period of time. In reading the records, I discovered that when I was leaving the hospital, the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation sent me for psychological testing, and even that psychologist just diagnosed me with schizophrenia, which would have been in 1966. But years later, it was very clear to both Dr. Heller, my doctor then, and the psychiatrist I had after that, that PTSD was my correct diagnosis.
All right, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What did you discover that would support that diagnosis? What did you discover about yourself and your experiences that was so traumatizing?
Some of the power of this is because times changed and people's awareness changed. But I also read the records in 2001, and it was very clear to me as a clinician in 2001 that it was incest. It was sexual abuse. But in addition, I think unwittingly, the shock treatment repeated the abuse.
Absolutely.
So, that also traumatized me.
Absolutely. Dr. Sawyer, you know, as we are talking about your experiences, and we started off with identifying who you are today as a clinical psychologist with your own practice, very much engaged in life, there's so many things that come up, at least for me, as we have our conversation and as I look at your book. Certainly the notion that patients can actually inspire their therapists. While that's not the patient's job, the fact that a therapist can be aware enough and connected enough, I think, to see how difficult it is and to work through the difficulty is really a gift to both, I would say, the therapist and the client. What's your thought about that?
I think that's true. I think it's, having been a patient or client, I know it can feel so sort of small and helpless and needy. But I think I think it's important that people know that their therapists are human and that they in fact have a real connection and that their work makes a difference too.
The website to which people can go for more information about you and your book is what?
I have two that actually go to the same place.
Okay.
So it's www.anitasawyer.com, and my Anita has two N's.
Okay.
That's just one word, or the name of the book, which is www.smokingcigarettes-eating-glass.com.
Okay. Dr. Sawyer, I am actually disappointed that our time is up, but hopefully we will be able to talk again. Thank you so much for the work that you do and for the time you've been able to share with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be able to say what I feel I need to say.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand 24/7 at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Production staff includes Janice White and several others. Arielle Smith, there are many more. Folks, again, thank all of you who participate in Mind Talk and who listen to Mind Talk. It is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And once again, you can always go to myndtalk.org for information about Mind Talk and to listen to any Mind Talk program. And remember, too, if it's unacceptable, then that is exactly what it is, unacceptable. You take care. Thank you.